John Burns.
Good morning, Mr. Burns. This is Shana Thurman. I'm the courtroom deputy at the U.S. Court of Appeals, and we are ready for oral argument.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead, Judge.
Hello, Mr. Burns.
Yes, ma'am.
This is Judge Rogers. I want to be sure you can hear me.
I'm
here with Judge Tatel and Judge Williams. Do you want to present your statement, and we may interrupt you with questions?
I would be happy to do so, and I understand I have 10 minutes.
Yes.
Your Honor, this is a case at the outset which is a little bit unusual to start. I must say, as a litigant, I don't think I've ever been unopposed in two prior litigations and lost both of them and come to a higher court of appeals to argue the case. But circumstances being where they are, that is what I have done. This case involves an area of deep concern to me as a practitioner and, of course, as a personal litigant in the case, and that is the appropriate scope of Rule 11. In this case, we function as a consumer bankruptcy law firm, which means that we are sort of on the front lines, as it were, of battle in the litigation that arises in these consumer bankruptcy cases. That means I, as a sole practitioner and as the attorney who represents these debtors, has to make a number of decisions in very short time frames and with various considerations that have to be balanced. In this particular case, as the facts have demonstrated from the brief, Ms. Haylock, who was the debtor in the case, came to our firm about an hour and a half to 2 hours before scheduled foreclosure. I will tell Your Honors, this is not uncommon. This is balanced, of course, against a theoretical set of tests that are found in the bankruptcy code as to a number of items that counsel must consider under his duties imposed by Rule 11, one of them being waivers of credit counseling. The waiver of credit counseling statute is found, of course, at 109H, and specifically at 109H3A, as concerns a waiver. And the waiver specifically states, as is in my brief, that in order to obtain a waiver of credit counseling, the debtor must have sought credit counseling and demonstrate within 5 days from an approved agency that he or she was unable to obtain that credit counseling, have exigent circumstances, and that it must be satisfactory to the court. Now, that sounds very simple on paper, and it sounds very simple, I'm sure, in the committee rooms where Congress debated this section of the statute, and that all is fine. But in the actual real world, when people come in who are often uneducated, a lot of times under medical conditions, sometimes under medication, and in deep, deep, deep financial distress, moments, hours, or even a day before they have a foreclosure where they can lose their house without a right of redemption, their ability to convey and even understand the efforts they have made at credit counseling can sometimes be less than ideal.
So I am clear. As I understand and read the district court's order, he found that you had not made sufficient inquiries of your client to determine whether or not what the judge said was plain on the face of the statute, she had received this credit counseling from an approved agency 5 days before. Is that your understanding? And the judge found that that was a violation of Bankruptcy Rule 911.
I think there were two issues, and they intertwined, so I have to address them in conjunction. The first was that the judge did ask, and I answered, as to the issue of what inquiry I had made under the reasonable inquiry standard under Rule 11. And my response, of course, was that the debtor said she had gone to a church, that she had gone with her daughter on the Internet, which is oftentimes how you get these approved credit counseling certificates, but she did not have a great deal of detail beyond that. There was no third party from whom inquiry could be made. She did not have her daughter's number available. It was an interesting situation, but you have someone here who's elderly, frightened, and had all of the facts that they could give me in their head. In other words, there wasn't any extraneous information she had brought or could brought. The second issue, which I think is intertwined, Your Honor, is how courts have treated what represents a reasonable attempt to get credit counseling. And I argued to the trial court that there are a number of efforts that have no relationship, even on their face, to approved credit counseling agencies, and yet courts across the country in various settings have taken that as satisfactory because of their impression, rightfully or wrongfully, but published impressions, that they believe the requirement is both onerous and unduly subject to question as to what is a reasonable attempt. The second issue, which I think was entwined in that answer, is the question of when someone has to do that. And I did raise on the plain statement of the language of the code, there is no relationship in 109H3A, subsection 2, to the petition date. It simply says...
Mr. Burns, this is Judge Tatel. As I read the bankruptcy judge's decision here, he says that the problem here is that you allowed your client to check this form, which said, I certify that I requested counseling service from an improved agency. And isn't the right thing to have done here to have said, look, you can't check that, you didn't do it. We'll put a note on here saying, you know, I checked with my church, I went on the internet, and under your theory, you think some courts might let you do the approved counseling afterwards, right?
Your Honor, that's an excellent question, and let me explain why we don't do that.
Yeah.
These are computerized forms which do not allow for editorialization. You have to check boxes. And the way a case would be filed with a waiver, whether there's an argument to be made or an argument not to be made.
Well, there's a place for a comment, right?
Your Honor, I don't see one, and we have never been able to get the form to open up. I mean, I know this sounds like somewhat of a simplistic analysis.
Oh, but she says, there's not a blank space to describe exigent circumstances?
Your Honor, I am looking at the form at this time. If you'd be good enough to give me a moment, I'd...
Yeah, sure, go ahead. You mean it's not there? Huh.
But Your Honor may be correct. I have to double check because normally...
Because the record quotes that she wrote in there, debtor was unable to obtain credit counseling prior to foreclosure. That's written in.
Your Honor, on the petition, and again, I am...
I'm just looking at this form. What's the number? Exhibit B. No. D. D. Exhibit D.
Yeah. That's Exhibit D. See, it's page 6 of the joint appendix, or of your appendix.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And my understanding is you moved for waiver.
We did move for waiver. And the waiver was based, and you'll have to forgive me for reasons that I suppose are more my embarrassment than anything else. I don't have my reading glasses with me today. I didn't know I had court this morning. I forgive me. But I am looking at the document, and there is a box that is checked off. When you file a petition that either says you have completed credit counseling or you haven't, and by definition, if you haven't, you're seeking a waiver.
And see, right at the end of that, it says in italics, summarize exigent circumstances here. I think that's...
And that's where you write in, debtor was unable to obtain credit counseling prior to scheduled foreclosure, which is certainly...
I see what you're saying. Right. Forgive me, Your Honor.
What?
And that is correct. That is our position, is that she was unable to obtain it because having heard her for the period of time that I was able to meet with her, which was sometime probably about 45 minutes of total intake time, the debtor was able to tell me she had done her best, but she was unable to get it. And
the
question,
certification is that she asked for it and couldn't get it.
I understand, Your Honor, and I think the case law that's out there that speaks to what that means when you go into a bankruptcy court and explain what efforts were done is a little all over the board.
Okay, no, I got you on that. I understand that. But isn't there a difference between there's two parts to 9/11 here, right? There's sub 2 and sub 3, B2 and B3. And B2 has to do with legal arguments, and B3 has to do with factual assertions, right?
I would agree with Your Honor's summary.
Okay.
That's correct.
So, many of these, I could understand. So one possible scenario is Okay, so you put on the form, she consulted her church and the internet, and under the circumstances of this case, and you know, it was rushed, that's the best she could do, and we'll get credit counseling tomorrow from an approved agency, and then you make your argument that's okay, and that way at least you're only talking about B2, right? Do you have a non-frivolous argument that that's okay? You don't have a B3 problem because everything you said on Form D was true, or at least supported by evidence. But the bankruptcy judge seems to see this as a B3 problem. Here, I'll show you what I mean. He says, I'll give you an example. A Joint Appendix 80, okay? The bankruptcy judge says, he says, if an attorney knows that the debtor is ineligible for relief based on 109H, as occurred here, that attorney cannot file a petition without violating Rule 9/11. That's the way the bankruptcy judge was looking at it, and I didn't see anywhere in your brief here that you challenged that finding.
Your Honor, let me try to do so at this time.
No, but you didn't in the brief, right?
Your Honor,
counsel,
I thought I did.
Can I just get an answer?
We can't all talk at once. Wait, let's just get it one at a time. Okay. Counsel, can you respond first to Judge Tatel's question?
I'd be delighted to. Okay. Let me explain my position as it relates to that question. In filling out a bankruptcy petition, I am often guided, and perhaps maybe it is an error, but I don't think it is, by the tenet of Rule 8 of the Civil Procedure Rules, which says basically a short statement describing the relief. And perhaps I could have put in more factual information to say that she attempted. I think she attempted. I think she went online with her daughter. She did the best she could under the circumstances, which I understand dovetails into the legal issue, because under the legal issue, obviously, courts have looked at what constitutes a reasonable effort to get the credit counseling, and the decisions are all over the map. In filling out the petition, I took the position, knowingly, that if a debtor went out and did her best to get credit counseling, even if I was unable to independently prove she went to an approved credit counseling agency, that would be sufficient in my mind to meet my responsibility because of the case law that existed out there saying that there were divergent opinions, analyses, and reasoning as to what constituted reasonable effort to obtain credit counseling. So should I have put more words down in that little spot to say that she went to her church and she tried to get something off the internet? Candidly, and I mean this with the greatest of due respect, I don't know that it would have made a difference. Maybe in Judge Teel's mind it would have. I certainly didn't pick that up as a litigant in the case. I think the way I saw his opinion was based on the reasoning that it was almost a strict liability statute, likening it to a statute of limitations defense where there is no statute of limitations defense or something of that type. And I tried to focus in my argument to Judge Teel on the amendments in 1997 to the rules, creating less of a strict liability standard and more of a flexible one, dependent on the factual circumstances. So my view on it was that, number one, if she made her best effort, I was aware of decisional case law that said that was going to be sufficient. And I thought in putting down that the debtor was unable to obtain credit counseling prior to scheduled foreclosure was a factually accurate statement. It was. I have no doubt in my mind, to a moral certainty, that it was.
Counsel, passage that Judge Tatel called your attention to has two aspects. One is a factual proposition about your knowledge, and the other is a legal proposition about what can pass muster. And for the second part, what can pass muster, the court addresses that in more detail on the prior page 79, And alluding to your cases, the cases you cited, including Mesa, the court says these cases, do not stand for the proposition that an attorney, knowing that a debtor cannot satisfy the requirements of Section 109H, having failed to make inquiry, satisfies the requirements of 9011, when he proceeds to sign and file a petition. But those, in a sense, that's true. They don't stand for that proposition, because they stand for the proposition that substantial compliance is enough, right? And you, as I understand it, were resting on the legal view supported by Mesa that substantial compliance is enough. So you knew that, right? In other words, you didn't, under your view of the law as supported by Mesa, you did not know that the debtor could not satisfy the requirements of 109H.
That is absolutely correct, and I tried to make that clear at both hearings in June and January. And I do think it's important to note that there are two requirements. One is the actual credit counseling agency issue, and the second is the timing of the request. I supplied case laws to both elements, the first being what is substantial compliance, and my view, both prior to and after the filing of the Haylock case, based on published decisions, that we had met that substantial compliance. And secondarily, of course, that the five-day requirement under the DePinto case is not even articulated as a necessarily pre-petition event. Now, I've never taken the position that the DePinto case is a majority opinion, but it's a published opinion. I'm entitled to rely on it, and I'm entitled to ask for a good faith extension or interpretation of existing law based on it. That's how I viewed it. And when I put down in the petition that the debtor was unable to obtain her credit counseling, I meant it. She was unable to obtain it, but I don't think anyone today has a definitive opinion or statutory revision as to what 109H3 means.
Just following up on this form, when you file the petition, you're doing it electronically,
yes,
and you have this opportunity to put in some text. If the Chapter 13 trustee moves to dismiss, in the usual case, do you have an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
At that point, could you have brought in your client to testify about her efforts?
Yes, Your Honor. We tried to reach the client. She, as is stated in the record, I believe in my July 9th
Right. So filing. At that point, you two had lost contact.
Well, she was in the hospital.
Right.
That I was able to confirm.
But, I mean, you were unable to reach her.
That's correct.
See, I'm sorry, Judy.
Go ahead. No,
Judge. See, the certification that this the bankruptcy judge said, the certification you allowed your client to make, quote, I certify that I requested counseling from an approved agency. The bankruptcy judge says you did not inquire as to whether that was true or not. And that was the violation of 9/11. And I asked you whether you would challenge that in the brief, and you said you didn't, but you do it now.
I misspoke, if I may address that. I think what I should have said is that my view on that is that it's a bit different, perhaps, than the question I'm being asked. And let me try to clarify it this way.
Well, let me say one more thing before you do. And also in the testimony before the bankruptcy judge, you answered this question and said, no, you didn't know. Right.
Well, I said that I did not know other than what she told me.
No, you said you didn't know whether she had approached an approved agency.
That's correct.
Yeah. And the certification said I did approach an approved agency.
And let me try to respond
in answer
to your question.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I entirely agree that I have no personal knowledge and had no personal knowledge whether she approached an approved agency for credit counseling other than what she told me as to going on the Internet, which could or could not have been an approved agency. Number two.
Yeah, but that's not what you told the bankruptcy judge when he asked you the question. You just said, no, you didn't know.
In all fairness, as a matter of law, which I think overlaps to the fact, it's a little distinctive here. My view of what an approved credit counseling agency was and what inquiry I had to make was based on the published decisions I cited. In short, there are decisions interpreting all sorts of entities to be within the ambit of what was intended for approved credit counseling agency. So I must submit, in response to your direct question, did I certify that she had inquired to an approved credit counseling agency? The answer to that was I relied upon the case law determining that that definition of an approved credit counseling agency is debatable. Not only debatable, but quite frankly, far flung from what Congress may have intended.
Just out of curiosity, Mr. Burns, what are they normally? What is an approved? Can you just tell us about that? What are they?
I'd be happy to tell you.
Yeah.
The United States trustee sets up a panel of agencies that have met various criteria, including cost management and including a fairly unified curriculum. They do switch them from time to time. In all candor, the list is often outdated. But be that as it may.
Like, what kind of organizations are on the list?
There are various companies. They have names like Sharpwood and, Capital Resources and things of that nature.
And do they charge for their services?
$50.
$50. And then, so you go to there, and then they give you this certificate, right?
They give you a certificate.
And I see.
And then you're able to go into bankruptcy without any further impediments.
And our community... Are churches ever approved?
Yes. And they are approved in the context of affiliations. I think there's an Episcopal one. I could be wrong.
But the church would give... she didn't have a certificate, right?
She didn't have a certificate. None at all. None at
and
all.
And you can also do it on the Internet?
You absolutely can.
And that's where you would find the list?
That is where you would find the list for the particular agencies. We routinely open up the page for the District of Maryland in D.C. when we have people who come in and say, you know, they haven't been able to find one, and I say, does this name sound familiar? You even try to get them on the phone sometimes, but oftentimes they're busy. I mean, we did a lot within
that
45
companies
minutes.
That are set up just to do this? Is that
these companies are set up exclusively for this function. There's also
Do they ever, do they give real counseling? I mean, what do they do?
They sit there.
I know I'm going a little beyond the record here, but what in the world do they do for their $50?
They have... people who are between 17 and 19 years old read off a checklist of questions to a debtor about how much they spend on toilet paper, gas, whether they have too many people in their household, and they come up with a list at the end called a financial management budget that is nothing more than a computer set of entered numbers that have no relationship to anything.
And then does anybody ever change their position because of one of these counseling sessions?
That would be a miracle. That is.
Counsel?
Yes,
on this, the B2, B3 question, it seems to me, as I read the colloquy with the bankruptcy judge, in deciding not to award any sanction against the represented party, your client, he explicitly relies on B2. Isn't that the case?
You're talking B2 of Rule 11, I take it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that's accurate.
That's pages 122, 123 of the appendix.
I believe that that is accurate. The Judge Teel was very focused on the fact that he, in my view, and I think this is more evident from the January hearing than from the June hearing, that although there was case law presented that it was non-jurisdictional, which is important because I cited one of his earlier decisions to him where he spoke to the issues where it is jurisdictional under 109G. And, of course, there you're filing somebody who has no jurisdiction to be in bankruptcy. On 109H, it is not jurisdictional. At least there's debatable case law on that both ways, but the majority says not jurisdictional. But net-net, I raised with the judge the issue of the fact that contrary case law existed to what – I was being sanctioned for, which in my view, again, with all due respect to the factual representation, I believed I was representing to the court that she had not been able to obtain credit counseling from a scheduled or a listed credit counseling agency because of the definitional discussion of what that is under all the cases. And the judge's response was, well, I view this as a strict liability situation where if you raise, for example, a statute of limitations defense and there is no such defense, then, you know, you're on the hook. And I said, Your Honor, I don't think if I have a case that I'm relying on for an extension of existing law that I should be sanctioned because the court disagrees with the case. And that's what I saw the crux of the issues as surrounding. I hope that answered your question. I know I went beyond the scope of the inquiry, but if I didn't, please let me know.
All right, counsel, thank you. I think that will complete our hearing.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I appreciate the opportunity to have presented oral argument.
You're welcome.
Thank you, ma'am.
We'll take the case under advisement.
Yes, ma'am.
Stand, please.
Burns Law Firm. Burns Law Firm. Hello?
Mr. Burns, are you still online? Okay.
No, this is Ben.
Okay, we're finished for the day. You can hang up, and I thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.